there was actually three men there. Besides Robert Gearcy and Robert Henson, there was James Barker, who was good friends with Gearcy and Henson. Well, they went in, they found all three men had been bound hand and foot, and their throats cut. And actually, the coroner said their throats were cut so deep that one more whack probably would have beheaded them. But anyway, as you can imagine, with people dying this way, it was an extremely bloody scene. And so, of course, the friend ran back out and called the police. And this turned into an investigation. Of course, this investigation went on for years because it was a high-profile case. These two men who owned their own microphone company had become successful, but they later found out they were successful because they had stolen money, equipment, and customers from the previous employer who also worked in microfilm. Along with that, the police found that the three murdered men had been in a contest in 1971 to see who could bed the most women. The deal was it had to be someone that none of the other two knew. It had to be somebody new. And so, and they had kept a scorecard in their house there of the women each one had slept with. And then by December 1st, it was up to 63 women. So needless to say, this gave the police there's a lot of suspects. You got a lot of, but what happened to men after they had sex with women, they dump her and move on to the next one. So you had probably 63 irate women and who knows how many boyfriends and husbands. Again, like I said, they found out they had stolen equipment from their steel equipment, money, and customer, their previous boss. You had another suspect. These three guys also loved to go out party a lot. They liked to get in bar fights. So they had a lot of people didn't like them. These three reportedly would go up in a bar and find somebody sitting with a pretty girl and go up and hit on the girl while the guy was there. And of course, that would lead to a big bar fight. So that added another few dozen suspects to the list and all. Need to say, because of the gruesomeness of the crime and the fact about the sex contest and the list, this became a huge media event. In 1971, early 72, it was on the news every night, in the newspaper every day. The problem with this was there were so many suspects. I mean, the police had this list of 60 women. They also knew they'd beaten up all kind of guys in bars, and they were involved in some shady business deals to get their microfilming company going. But they had so many suspects. They weren't sure what to do because it seemed like every time they would find a suspect and rule him or her out, the previous suspect would give them two more suspects. Two more people didn't like these guys. And so eventually, this case was just crazy. I mean, every day people want to know, what have you discovered? And of course, every day all they discovered was that there were more suspects.
Hello, this is Mark. I read a weekly newspaper column about true crime, unsolved homicides, and the paranormal. You can find links to my social media accounts and columns on my website titled themarkhobb.com. Welcome to the Catch My Killer podcast, and thank you for listening. Before I get into this week's podcast episode, I would like to ask for your help. I'm looking for listeners to help support the podcast by buying me a cup of coffee. If you would like to help support the podcast, I'm asking you to subscribe to my monthly Crime Coffee Club, which is only $5 per month. If you subscribe to my monthly coffee fund, I will share exclusive content with you. To support the podcast, please visit catchmykiller.com and click on the donate link or on the buy me a coffee link. And that's enough of the coffee business. Now it's time to talk about this week's crime story. This week's story involves the brutal 1971 triple homicide of three men in Indianapolis, Indiana. On December 1st, 1971, a man named John Carnes hadn't heard from his friends, Robert Henson and Robert Gearcy. He visited the residence at 1318 North LaSalle Street to check on his friends. What he found was horrific. Someone had murdered Indianapolis businessmen Robert Henson, 30, James Barker, 27, and Robert Gearcy, 34. Their hands and feet were bound, and their throats had been cut. The men were nearly decapitated. Henson was found on his stomach in the front bedroom, with his hands bound beneath him. Barker was found on his back in the bathroom between the two bedrooms, and Gearsy was lying on his back in the rear bedroom. Marion County Coroner Dr. Dennis Nicholas believed that the victims were held by their hair to extend their necks and then have their throats cut from ear to ear with a knife. Death was probably instantaneous. Deputy Chief Ralph Lumpkin, head of investigations, told reporters, "It took more than one person to do this. These were large men, and they weren't old." Gearsy and Henson were friends who had quit their previous jobs working for businessman Ted Ulan to start their own microfilming business. The two men had allegedly stolen clients, money, and equipment from Ulan to start their own business. Authorities also learned that Ulan had taken life insurance out on Henson and Gearsy. The insurance led to Ulan becoming a prime suspect in the killings. Ulan had an alibi, so he was never charged. Law enforcement was sure that he had hired someone to kill the two men, but they didn't know who he had hired. During the 1990s, an independent journalist named Carol Schultz brought the triple homicide back to the forefront of Indianapolis news. She believed that a man named Carol Horton had possibly been involved in the killings. It was believed that Horton became upset after his ex-wife began dating one of the murder victims. Additionally, an acquaintance of Horton's named Michael Chastain, who was already serving two life sentences in a Florida prison, claimed that he and Horton had committed the homicides. But it was later discovered that he had lied to authorities. He had lied to get a respite from prison and a free trip to Indianapolis. In March 1996, Carol Horton was indicted for the murders and spent about a month in jail. It was discovered that Schultz had lied to Horton by telling him that his fingerprints were found at the homicide scene. It also came out that Schultz was negotiating a book and movie about the story. Her book erroneously blamed Horton for the homicides. Superior Court Judge Paula E. LaPosa criticized Schultz for leading the police to Horton's front door. The court finds that the investigation was compromised by the meddling of Carol Schultz, who is a very biased former investigative reporter, LaPosa said. In 2001, police received a letter written by a man named Fred Harbison, who had worked for Ulan and who had died a few years earlier, leaving the letter in a safe deposit box. It went open for a few years until the police eventually received it. Former Indianapolis Police Department Captain Robert Snow, who was in charge of the homicide unit in the late 90s, said that in the letter, Harbison claimed that Ted Ulan had hired him to kill the men, but never paid him for the killings. The letter read, "These two men I killed in their beds by cutting their throats, and there was another guy who wasn't supposed to be there, but I had to kill him too because he showed up." The letter continued, "Ted was supposed to pay me when he got the insurance money, but he kept putting me off because he said he had lost some money, but he said he would pay me as soon as he could." The paper said that a yellow Oldsmobile was seen at the place where I killed them, but it was really my yellow Plymouth Roadrunner. I buried my boots because the tracks, they found them, because I knew they could match up on the prints on my boots. Unfortunately, this case will never be prosecuted because Ted Ulan and Fred Harbison are both deceased. For this story, I spoke to retired Indianapolis police captain Robert Snow, and I also spoke to Mary Duke, who is the daughter of Carol Horton, the man falsely accused of the murders. They discussed the homicides and how a false accusation affected an innocent man. And now on with the story of the LaSalle Street Massacre. So I've been fascinated about this case for years. I mean, it's kind of like the Sylvia Likens case, where everyone in Indianapolis is familiar with this case. I mean, it is well known. And I saw that you had written a book about it, and I knew that you were a captain in the Indianapolis Police Department. I also know that someone else wrote a book about this case as well.
Her name's Carol Schultz, yeah. The police department, we believe in Occam's razor, which says the simplest explanation is usually the right one. And when I tell you what happened, you'll find this is the logical and the simplest explanation of what happened.
So tell me a little bit about yourself and all the time that you spent in the Indianapolis Police Department. And then I'd like to ask why you wrote this book. And then if you could just provide me with an overview of the story, because there are a lot of people who don't know about this story.
My name's Robert Snow. I was at the Indianapolis Police Department for 38 years, and I was a captain for 22 of those years. And I spent a long time as commander of the homicide branch. And this case we're going to talk about came to my attention about 30 years after it occurred. And when I was commander of the homicide branch, and that's eventually how it became solved. What happened was on the 1st of December, 1971, a friend of some people who lived at 1318 North of South Street, Robert Gearsey and Robert Henson, they both lived there, and a friend was trying to get a hold of them and couldn't reach them. He got concerned and went to 1318 North of South Street to see if he could find out why they weren't answering the phone, and they actually hadn't showed up for work. They owned their own microfilm business at that time, and they hadn't showed up yet. Now, these guys were really hard workers and had worked late the night before, and they were real hard partiers, too. So then the sleeping late wasn't that big a surprise. But anyway, this friend that went to check on them, so he went to the house on the South Street, and inside, he found a really gruesome scene. There was actually three men there, besides Robert Gearsey and Robert Henson. There was James Barker, who was good friends with Gearsey and Henson. Well, they went in, they found all three men had been bound hand and foot, and their throats cut. And actually, the coroner said their throats were cut so deep that one more whack probably would have beheaded them. But anyway, as you can imagine, with people dying this way, it was an extremely bloody scene. And so, of course, the friend ran back out and called the police. And this turned into an investigation. Of course, this investigation went on for years because it was a high-profile case. These two men who owned their own microphone company had become successful, but they later found out they were successful because they had stolen money, equipment, and customers from their previous employer who also worked in microfilm. Along with that, the police found that the three murdered men had been in a contest in 1971 to see who could bed the most women. The deal was it had to be someone that none of the other two knew. It had to be somebody new. And so they had kept a scorecard in their house there of the women each one had slept with. And then by December 1st, it was up to 63 women. So needless to say, this gave the police there's a lot of suspects. You got a lot of, but so what happened to men after they had sex with women, they dump her and move on to the next one. So you had probably 63 irate women and who knows how many boyfriends and husbands. But again, like I said, they found out they had stolen equipment from their steel equipment, money, and customers, their previous boss. You had another suspect. These three guys also loved to go out party a lot. They liked to get in bar fights. So they had a lot of people didn't like them. These three reportedly would go up in a bar and find somebody sitting with a pretty girl and go up and hit on the girl while the guy was there. And of course, that would lead to a big bar fight. So that added another few dozen suspects to the list and all. You say because of the gruesomeness of the crime and the fact about the sex contest and the list, this became a huge media event. In 1971, early 72, it was on the news every night, in the newspaper every day. The problem with this was there were so many suspects. I mean, the police had this list of 60 women. They also knew they'd beaten up all kind of guys in bars. And they were involved in some shady business deals to get their microfilming company going. But they had so many suspects. They weren't sure what to do because it seemed like every time they would find a suspect and rule him or her out, the previous suspect would give them two more suspects, two more people didn't like these guys. And so eventually, this case was just crazy. I mean, every day people want to know, what have you discovered? And of course, every day all they discovered was that there were more suspects. And one of the witnesses who had walked by their house earlier this evening said there was a yellow car without a county plates on it sitting in front of the house. It had Gibson County plates on it. And now, of course, this was Marion County, where they have Gibson County is about 2 hours drive south of Annapolis. But that never panned out to anything. So this case basically died because of so many suspects. And of course, this was before AFIS, which is the Automatic Fingerprint Identification System. In 1971, if a police officer found a fingerprint at a crime scene, if he or she, the police officer didn't have someone to check it against, a specific person to check against, the print part was useless. Because at that time, they had several million individual fingerprints on file. And there was no way to quick search through them. Now, AFIS is, of course, a computer program that came around about 2000, which does it on a computer. They can go through millions in just a few seconds and find and match up. And unfortunately, they didn't have them in those days. Also, there's a lot of blood in there. And again, this is for DNA. So the only thing you could do with blood in those days was type. It'd be one of, AB or O. And that didn't do any good either because like 25% of the people in the world are A positive. So that didn't do any good. So they had blood. They also had a bloody footprint in there, a so they could match their shoe or boot against the bloody footprint, but they never were able to. So it basically, about 1972, it just died because they couldn't rule out all these stuff. They had so many suspects, they couldn't find anybody they could possibly connect to the crime. So it just petered out and become an unsolved case.
So when did this case receive its biggest break?
That didn't come for a lot of years later. Because in 1991, 20 years later, an investigative reporter became interested in the case. And she began interviewing various people involved in the case. Someone told her about a gentleman named Carol Horton. And so she started concentrating on Carol Horton. So eventually she got a hold of a gentleman named Floyd Chastain. He was in prison at that time in Florida. And she was corresponding with him. And he was a previous co-worker with Carol Horton. And he insisted that he told her that he had been to crime. Eventually, he kept building the story. He kept telling her story and kept adding to the story. He told her that he had been to crime scene with Carol Horton. That Carol Horton had been the one who killed the three of them. Eventually, though, and believe it or not, the grand jury in Annapolis finally did indict Carol Horton and Chastain for murder. But unfortunately, after their initial hearing, there were so many discrepancies in the case and so little proof and so many people changing stories and facts that didn't prove out that the prosecutor dropped the case on. So the case basically died in 1996, they finally dropped the case. Well, in 2000, I was commander of the homicide branch then, and one of my detectives, Roy West, said he'd received information from a deputy of the Gibson County Sheriff's Department that said a woman had come in to see her and said she had information on a 1971 triple murder in Indianapolis. She believed the killer had been her father, a man named Fred Harbison. How she found this, she said after her dad had died, her mother went to the safe deposit box and then they found a really old letter addressed to the chief of police of Indianapolis. And in it, Mr. Harbison said that he'd been hired by Ted Ewan. Ted Ewan was the boss of the Henson and Gearcy before they started their own company. He was the one who they had stolen equipment, money, and customers from. They said that he'd been paid by Ted Ewan to kill these two because at that time he had executive insurance on Gearcy and Henson, which was a common practice in those days because these people are important to your organization, then a corporation will take insurance. And he had $150,000 insurance on both them. Now, that doesn't sound like, that's still a sizable amount of money. But believe me, in 1971, $150,000 was a huge amount of money. And interesting enough, the policies were getting ready to expire real soon, just a week or two after the murders, they were set to expire. So anyway, Detective West went down to Gibson County, where interesting enough, if you remember, a car was parked in front of the house that night that had Gibson County plates on it. But anyway, he went down to Gibson County and talked to this lady. And when you have a big murder like this, you have one that's huge on publicity, you never tell all the facts. The reason you don't tell all the facts to the public is because you'll have all kind of false confessions. If it's a high enough publicity murder, you'll have people come in only because they want to be famous. They think if they confess to a high-profile murder like this, they'll make them famous. And so you always got to hold some information back to see if they really did it. Because a lot of people study these crimes intensely, study every bit of information they can find on the crime. So when they go and confess, they sound truthful. They sound like, boy, this guy sounds like he's there. But if you hold out a few pieces of information, this person might know that. Well, the police had never told anybody about the bloody footprint. And in the letter, Fred Harbison said that he knew he had made a bloody footprint in the scene and that he'd buried his boots in a groundhog hole that night to keep him identified. And when Wes talked to his wife, she said she remembered him coming home about sometime 1971 with no boots. And he had told her that he buried them. And she just said, okay, she didn't want to know why. And so the letter gave all the information about the murder and what had happened, and why he had, because again, since Gearcy and Hinton had stolen his equipment and stolen his customers, Ted Ewan's getting ready to go bankrupt. And so he was in bad financial shape, and he really needed this $150,000 bad. Interesting enough, though, the prosecutor, when they were investigating this case, the prosecutor asked Ted Ewan to take a lie detector test, and he said he would, but he never did. Another fact that was interesting about that is that the three men had been tied hand and foot, but the police noticed these were really funny knots. They weren't the granny knots. These are some kind of special knots that only people who are experienced in tying knots would know about. And actually, they sent the FBI to see if they identified what kind of knot they were. Interesting enough, according to people who knew Fred Harbison, he was an expert in tying knots and used to like to show people all the different kind of knots he could tie. Another point that went to the the favor is that the house had no signs of forced entry. And these are three, but these are the guys who were there, the three murder men, were all three big hulking guys who loved to fight. So police were wondering, how could a guy get control, come into the house, get control of these three men? If you knock the door, would they let you in and let you tie them up and beat them? You know, what had happened, though, is they found out there was no one forced entry, but Ted Ewan had a key to their house. I'm not sure why, but they had given Ted Ewan a key to their house. And the police believe that somebody snuck in the back door and waited for them to come home, because the three men apparently all came there at different times. Here's enough. Besides the slit throat, all three men had really bad blows to the back of the head. It looked like it was done with a tire iron or some similar tool. All three, they believe that whoever had snuck in the house in the back door had hit them with a tire iron to make them helpless enough to tie them up. Finally, Wes was able to gather all the information up that the prosecutor actually considered the case solved and closed. But again, it was 30 years later.
So is it officially closed? Because every time I look up information about this case, it always says that it's still open.
No, I had the prosecutor send us a statement that said, what did he say? He said, in the message, we got a message from Deputy Prosecutor John Common, a man involved, who had been involved in North of Southgate for many years. The message, Common said, has long been my personal opinion that most likely Ted Ewan, along with unknown accomplices, committed these crimes. This is my personal recommendation, based upon my years of experience and intimate knowledge of the history of this case, they'd be given the exceptional clearance and closed. They consider it solved and closed. But now you're going to say, why didn't this make the papers? Why did you, like you said, why, if you look at it now, it still says open? Let me tell you why. In 1971, the police had assured the public numerous times that they would solve this case. This case would be solved. This vicious murder we brought to justice, okay? They did it over and over. And of course, it blew up in their face because they eventually couldn't do it. They eventually had to just put the case as unsolved. So that was bad. That was embarrassing enough. In 1991, police came involved in the case against two, and they actually arrested people on this case. They again blew up in their face. In Indiana, there is no bond for murder. If you're arrested for murder, there's no bond. Unless exceptional case where the judge thinks the evidence is so weak that it can't, you know, it's not a good case. Well, the judge let Carol Horton loose on $5,000 bonds. And the judge basically said in court, this is the most ridiculous case I've ever seen. So that afternoon, the prosecutor dropped the charges. So again, the police, when this whole thing blew up, the police's face again. So when Roy started getting all the information in this case, I met with the deputy chief of investigation, the chief of police, and they were really hesitant about opening this case again, because again, it blew up in our face twice before. So I told them, we got some good information. They basically said, okay. He said, okay, follow the case, do what you need to do, but no media. The news media does not know about this. We don't want the media involved in this at all. And I could see their point, because again, something that blows in your face twice, you're a little scared the third time. So we did it and never did make any kind of media releases on it, even though the case had been solved.
Do you think anything will ever be given to the media to show that this case was officially solved?
This is 1971 when it happened, so nobody really cares that much anymore as they did. Now, if this had happened 20 years ago, everybody would be really interested and excited about it, because there was a whole lot of publicity in 1991 when Carol Schultz reopened the case. There was a lot of excitement about the case again, and then it blew up in the police face when the prosecutor dropped all the charges and the judge told them how bad the case looked. So again, we were embarrassed. So that believe me, they didn't want a third round of this. So we solved the case, but there was no media involvement at all.
So you're saying that they didn't want to take a chance of having a screw-up for a third time?
They wanted to see if it was solved, but again, we didn't want to announce anything to the media. They didn't want to make, because in 1991 and 1971, they had announced to the media a number of times, just cases solved, in 1971, they had said how we're going to find this killer. We promised Biden 48 hours, and then that would be another week, then another week. We'll solve it, we promise, and nothing happened. In 1991, they come out and said it's all been solved. Everything is solved. The case is gone. And again, it wasn't. So you're going to get a little gun shy after that.
For this part of the story, I spoke to Mary Duke, who is the daughter of Carol Horton, who was falsely accused of killing the three men on LaSalle Street. To start this story off, I wanted to ask you about your dad. So tell me about Carroll Horton. Who was this man, falsely charged with committing a triple homicide?
I did live with him the whole time. I had just moved out about a week before he was arrested. He was a pretty good guy. My dad was Carroll Horton. He was in his early 40s, 50s, 1970. He was a lot older than my mom. I'm a May-December relationship baby. But my dad, he was a great guy. As far as my experience with him, he was an Indy 500 pioneer, and he worked every day of his life. He knew he died because he missed work. That's how I knew he passed away. Worked very hard, too. As far as relations to the murders, his ex-wife was the girlfriend of Robert Gears. And I know a little bit about that.
So was the second wife your mother, or was she your stepmother?
My mom and her had the same name. This is my stepmother, both of them named Diana Horton. Okay. But she'd already divorced my dad by the time she was dating Robert Gears. And as far as I know, she never cheated on my dad. My dad never had any negative things to say about Diane. My dad admitted to going to the crime scene after it happened. He admitted that he was worried about Diana. He came to the crime scene and the detectives actually called him inside the house. This is what he told me. He told me a lot of things that's not making sense.
Was your dad a jealous type? Because from what I understand, he was accused because it was said that he was jealous over his ex-wife dating the murder victim.
I can say my dad did have a jealous streak. I witnessed him beat my mother quite frequently when they were married. I don't know if he's guilty of these murders, but he's been guilty of several other things too that have gone through court. But my experience with my dad is a little different. My dad was nice to me, taught me everything.
Well, as his daughter, you would know him better than a lot of people would. So tell me why he got accused of doing this, and how did he end up getting arrested?
At that time, my dad was talking to Carol Schultz. My dad let on that there was some kind of relationship with her. She had been at the house. He would talk about Carol Schultz for all the time, that she's writing him love letters and all this stuff. I was like, why is this woman, you know, I never met her. If I had met her, maybe it'd been different, but I felt kind of uneasy about this. I'm like, why are you talking to this woman? He blew it off. She just wants to know about some things, and she's really nice. What do you think about me dating her? And I'm like, Dad, you don't know her. My dad started showing me letters from Michael Chastain and telling me what's going on. Say, hey, they're looking up this murder. I'm trying to help them. But Michael Chastain's writing back and forth to my dad as he's talking to Carol. And it was a little weird. I don't think that Michael Chastain had anything to do with the murders, but this reporter lady is writing me, promising me money and a free trip to Indianapolis. I mean, it was crazy. I mean, that's what I read through the letters. That's what Michael Chastain had wrote to my dad. And I thought, that dad, you need to stop talking to her. She's not in your favor, Dad. Quit talking to her. He goes, oh, I just got to clear it up. I'm like, no, you don't talk to this lady anymore. She's trying to get you. So my dad had told me what had happened before he got arrested. Well, let me tell you about Carol Schultz. All right, she was trying to implicate my dad in these murders. So my dad had said he knew the actual guy that committed the murders. And I believe the name was Fred Harbison. He admitted that he had done this. That's all I know. But he admitted to the murders. He said the payout on Gearson Henson were like $150,000. And apparently, like, Gearson Henson were stealing their, my dad said, the guy had already planned this out. They had left the firm or whatever. And the guy's, I need this money. You know, this is what's going to happen. I kind of believe my dad may have been involved somehow because he knew too much before this stuff even was public knowledge. You know, I mean, this happened in 96. That guy didn't have his deathbed confession until 1999. And my dad had already been dead.
So according to Robert Snow, the killer was definitely Fred Harbison, because someone had seen his yellow car parked outside the house and identified his plate from a different county. Harbison had also left bloody footprints, which was never released to the public. And he mentioned that. So he described things about the case that were never publicly released.
My dad also told me this before any death confession. He wanted me to know he didn't do it. He didn't have any physical evidence. But yeah, my dad knew a lot of stuff. I mean, how do you not have any evidence, no fingerprints? All of that shit was gone. My dad admitted that he went to the crime scene after the murders. He said he went there and went inside the house with the detective because he was being questioned about Diane's involvement. But he said he went there to go see if Diane was okay or what had happened, because he had heard about what's going on. And he also said the dude that killed the guy got stiffed out of the money. So something happened. A lot of people didn't get paid. So my dad had actually said something about that. This is burnt into my memory because my dad said, I need to talk to you. And he started telling me all this stuff. And I'm like, Dad, maybe you need to tell your lawyer. After he was arrested, he got Barry Shep to come and represent him from the Freedom Project.
Yeah.
My dad got arrested a week later after he told me about what happened. He knew about who did it, how it went down, and all that stuff before. And Michael Chastain worked for my dad when he was like 18. He was like really young.
I know what I think got your dad into trouble was when Chastain had said that him and your dad had committed the murders together, but then Chastain recanted his confession. But then there was no proof that either man was involved in the crime.
There was no proof because there is no proof. There's no blood. There's no evidence. We can't even test anything right now. It's very hard for me. I know how my dad was. My dad was a genius, but he was the devil in the same form. And like I said, he never did anything to me. But other people in my family, he was a really bad person. It's hard for me to disrespect my dad, but I have to tell the truth about what's going on. He was involved with a lot of bad people. My dad had bad business dealings. I feel so sorry for the family of these victims. They had family. They had a mom and dad. They lost their kids. And they don't have any answers. And I feel like, wow, they should have had answers.
Carol Schultz also wrote a book about this case.
Yeah, she wrote a book about me threatening her. She said somebody was after her. That was me. I said, I hate you. You lied and wrote about my dad. I saw her book at the airport, and I was so embarrassed. I bought the book, and I read it, and I'm like, oh, my goodness. I knew she was going to write a book because she had offered my family members money if they would give her information, like so much of her profits. She came after my grandmother and tried to get my grandma to talk. And I don't know if my grandma did talk. My grandma hated my dad. But I'm like, how did my dad know so much information about the crime? There's still people that you do bad dealings with and get what you need. If I need this done, I'm going to pay you and I'll do favors for you and I'll get this done. But my dad was part of that crew. He did questionable dealings in his lifetime. My dad was in prison for a month, or jail for a month, and I think a month and a half, or I think it was. I had reporters at my door at 6 a.m. in the morning when I was getting ready for school the next day. I walked out, answered the door, and they're like, Diana Horton? And I'm like, who are you looking for, my mom? And I was like, what's this about? They're like, well, the South Street murders and this and that. And I'm like, that's my dad. And my mom didn't have anything to do with it. She wasn't with him at the time. But I had to go to school the next day. I had to go to school. And my teacher seen that shit. And they were like, Mary, you're seeing your dad. My dad actually came to school and he would talk about World War II. My dad was a veteran. And I had him come to school a couple of times to talk about history, that kind of thing. And they're like, oh, I see your dad on TV. Did he do it? Did he do it? And the kids would be like, oh, my God. Yeah, we seen it too. It was constant beratement by people. I mean, to the point where I didn't want to go to school anymore. I asked my dad if I can go with him on Gerardo Rivera. It's caused a lot of trauma and a lot of issues I have now. I remember almost everything that went on. It's just so hard. I can remember, what's his name, Michael Chastain, write my dad and apologize that he had to lie. He said, I had to tell him so I could see my family in Indianapolis, because he's from here. And apparently he got visitations and all kinds of stuff. Got the A1 treatment while he was up here testifying against my dad.
Now tell me about what happened after your dad got acquitted and came home.
After he got acquitted, he was bitter. My dad had built a business. Let's tell you about my dad. All right, he came to Indianapolis. He ran away from an abusive household. My grandfather was abusive. I mean, he would beat my dad, my grandmother. He's from Arkansas, a place called Grubbs, Arkansas. But my dad ran away at 16, came to Indianapolis, and he started working for a local bike shop. And he worked his way up from working on bicycles to motorcycles. Then he got drafted into the Army, I think when he was 18. It was the very end of the war. He got put in France right after D-Day. He was walking around France, liberating these concentration camps, and he would tell me stories. I looked up his army records. He would walk around and see them, the depravity of what the Germans did. When he was on his way home, he got in an airplane crash, and he was one of 13 survivors off the transport plane. I could never get my dad on a plane ever again. But I didn't know why until after I found out that he was in that accident. He came back to Indianapolis and started working on cars and eventually made his way and had Jerry Alderman Ford give him a race team where he started working on race cars. He was chief mechanic for over 10 years. I think it was 10 years. 1964, I have pictures of this stuff. I mean, I've done so much Googling. I don't have his original photos, but I have a lot, you know, that I've dug up over the years. His car, 1964, made fourth place in the Indy 500. He got beat by Mario Andretti. Al Miller was his race car driver. And he did a lot through the years. He actually made his own car, the Horton. It was a Ford on a Lotus body, Ford engine with a Lotus body. My dad actually has an engine in the 500 museum. When I was growing up, I would get tickets. We would go to the 500. My dad would get free tickets, free pit passes. We'd go to the pit passes. He'd have what's called a gold badge. So that meant he can go anywhere in the pit and run around. And we'd go to the 500 dinners, which was kind of cool. After my dad had been indicted, nobody would talk to him. Alan Sir, none of the people that he worked with. My dad worked with Carroll Shelby to help him design a race team. And nobody would talk to him anymore. They cut all ties with my father. It ruined his business. My dad had built cars, Indy cars, up from 1990 because they got computerized. He couldn't build them anymore. So it really broke my dad's heart that these people wouldn't have anything to do with him. You know, they're like, hey, you're the South Street murderer. We're not having nothing to do with him. And apparently Carroll Schultz had tried to interview some of the people that he had dealings with. And they're like, we're not talking to you, you know. It ruined his business. But my dad worked every day. Like I said, I knew my father had passed away on New Year's of 1999. But my dad didn't go to work. I had seen him two nights before. And my dad said his tummy hurt a little bit, that he was going home. And me and my girlfriend had came seeing him. And I'll say, Dad, you know, I'm moving me back in, you know, next week. Just let me, I had a couple things at school to do and I was going to move back in with him because I wasn't getting along with my mom. And he said, that's fine. I said, Dad, you know, call me when you get home. Let me know how you feel and everything. And I should have done something then, but you don't know. It was a stomach ache. The next day we had a major blizzard. It was so bad that you couldn't leave the house. And I had actually drove out to my dad's and I seen a car that had pulled up. I thought, well, maybe it'd be my dad and he decided he was going to go home, actually take a day off, you know, but it wasn't. It happened to be one of his workers that worked. And I'm like, I went home and I said, you know what? My dad's not at work. You know, my mom's first thing said, she came out of her mouth, he's dead. And I was like, how could you say that? And then it got me all worried. So me and my brother decided it was time to go out there. My brother said, stay home. So my brother went first. And he said that my dad was in this chair, but he's not moving or answering the door. And so we went over there and broke into this house. My dad had been dead. He had put his feet on the heater and passed away. I was only 18 at the time. And it was traumatic for me. It was like, wow. So we had him cremated and had him buried. But I think it affected his life. It shortened his life, definitely. All the stress on his heart. I mean, how could you not think that every 5 minutes that they're not going to come and get you anytime? It affected me tremendously. I have issues now. Like, I see a psychiatrist from my childhood trauma, and I have like diagnosis, like PTSD and some other things going on from this. I was scared shitless because I didn't know if my dad was going to prison for the rest of his life, what was going to happen. But like I said, my dad knew about who done it before he even admitted, because the deathbed confession came out. My dad knew exactly who did it. And I'm like, how would my dad know who did it? I idolized my dad when I was growing up. My dad was my hero. I wanted to be my engineer and build race cars like my dad. Like today, I'm so smart about cars. I could tell you what's wrong with your car. I could tell you how engine works. I could tell you everything.
So from what I understand, again, according to Robert Snow, your dad was cleared. I mean, they have Fred Harbison listed as the killer and the case is officially closed. So your dad is no longer considered involved in the case.
But Fred Harbison did not do it by himself. You cannot kill three people by yourself. Two people and then three people to tie somebody up and slit their throat. Two people to talk. You got to put your gun down to tie somebody up. And to make somebody else tie somebody up, they're going to do it wrong. It's not possible to have somebody do that.
Right. And after talking to Robert Snow, he also told me that most likely there was another guy involved, because the police just don't think that one person could have done this alone. I also learned that Harbison had a friend that hung around with him all the time, so it was possible that he may have also been involved, but nothing ever became of it. And after all this happened, didn't your dad file a lawsuit?
The lawsuit was for wrongful arrest and imprisonment. wrongful arrest.
And your dad never received any compensation for being falsely accused. Is that correct?
No, never compensated, never exonerated until Robert Snow wrote this book. The only person that stuck up for him was Dick Cady of the Indianapolis Star. Dick Cady wrote so many things about him. He was a good friend of my dad's. Like I said, my dad died 2 years later. This killed my father, robbed me and my dad. I mean, my dad, I always knew he was going to die because he was so old. We used to go to air shows and car shows and things like that. He did things with me that I remember the rest of my life, but it killed him. Being charged with that and then everybody thinking that you did it, it will ruin your life. My thinking is he knew he may not have done it, but he did know who did it because he named these people way before anybody else even said anything about these people. And I wish they would have contacted me. I would have gave the dude's name before he died. You know what I mean? I could have told him who it was. My dad told me, you know, who it was. Nobody questioned me.
Did your dad know Fred Harbison?
He did.
I was thinking that it was possible that they may have known each other.
He known him. He known his buddy. He named him, too. I've heard this guy's name like 50 million times. Maybe he heard it from his friend. I don't know. But my dad was quite aware of the killing. I was a teenager. I went along with my life. I didn't know anything about this confession a few years ago. I got scared because my dad's telling me that he might be arrested for this crime he didn't do. I'm like, Dad, you're not going to get arrested. You didn't do anything. I'm reassuring and all that. But it was traumatic, and I remember everything.
I concluded this story with author Robert Snow's final thoughts about this case. Now, can you tell me a little bit more about this Fred Harbison? Who exactly was he?
Fred Harbison worked Ted Ulan, besides being in the microfilm business, also had an oil business. Fred Harbison was what they call roughneck at the oil business. And the funny thing about Fred Harbison, everybody that Roy West talked to about him said, yep. He'd have done it. Nobody seemed surprised he'd been accused. He'd been admitted this in the letter or been accused of it. Everybody thought, yep, he was very capable of it. He basically did odd jobs for Ted Ulan. What I find kind of interesting, though, is that now, Fred Harbison was also a tough, vicious man to cut all these three guys' throat and kill him. He was scared to death of Ted Ulan. Now, you think Ulan must have really been a bad guy. He was really scared of Ted Ulan, even though he was a pretty bad guy himself. So I don't know. Why Ted Ulan had done his life, but did enough that Fred Harbison was scared of him. I thought that was kind of interesting. Fred Harbison, they had found one of the witnesses that night said there was a yellow vehicle with a 26A, which is Gibson County plate, parked in front of the house. And I'm never sure why this didn't play big into the original investigation. To me, it seemed like it should have rung all kind of bells and red lights. But anyway, he said that was his yellow Roadrunner. And then they found out that, yes, in those days, in 1971, he had a yellow Roadrunner with Gibson County plates on it.
So that was the car that was seen sitting outside.
It was Fred Harbison. Fred said in his letter, Fred Harbison, that was my yellow Roadrunner that was parked in front of the house with the 26A Gibson County plates. I think there were just so many suspects and so much confusion. I mean, the police couldn't go anywhere after the media following them. So much confusion in this case, it just slipped through the cracks. It turned out later, when they found out who really did it, it became crucially important.
I also read that Fred didn't get paid for committing the murders either.
That is why Fred put the letter in the safe deposit box. Yeah, Ted Ulan had promised to pay him when the insurance came in, and then he didn't. And like I said, Fred Harbison was kind of scared of Ted Ulan, but still, he told Ted, well, I'm putting this, if I don't get my money, I'm going to put a letter in the safe deposit box. You know, if I die before you do, the police are going to come get you type thing. But as it turned out, he died before Ted Ulan did. Then he put it in there simply because he hadn't been paid and he wanted to strike back at Ted Ulan for not paying him for killing these three guys.
That's a pretty violent crime. I mean, three people? That's a serial killer. Did he have any type of criminal record before?
Yeah, he'd been in trouble a number of times. Nothing like this. Though people said he bragged about killing people. They didn't know he's never been arrested or convicted for, but people said that he had bragged about killing other people. And nobody doubted that he was telling them the truth. He was known as a pretty, pretty tough, mean guy. And so they didn't surprise anybody, like I said, when he was accused of it.
But when he was alive, he wasn't even on the suspect list, was he?
No. And Fred Harbison never in anybody's mind. Nobody knew about him. And Ted Ulan was on the suspect list, yes. Because when you're the police officer, when you're going to a murder, you have to look who benefits most from this murder. I mean, you're going to kill somebody, you usually have to have some benefit. In other words, you're getting revenge or you're getting money for it. Well, in this case, if you look at all the people involved in the case, the person who benefited most from the murder was Ted Ewan. And then plus, these guys had really messed with him. They stole his customer list, women, they stole money from him, and to put him out of business. He had a microphone business that was going out of business because of these guys. And these guys were actually really doing fantastic because, again, they had a big customer base now. They had equipment that turned out to be Ted Ewan's equipment, and they had the money to go on. So actually, Ted Ewan had the best motive. Not only was he getting revenge, he was also getting the money.
Yeah, I see. So, and from what I've read, he did actually collect that $150,000.
Well, they didn't have any choice. I mean, they hadn't charged anybody in the crime. And so, and he had the insurance policies where they were in the grace period, but they were still open, valid the day these guys, two guys died. And so, yeah, they ended up paying $150,000. Again, like people think, well, that's not a whole lot of money. Yeah. In 1971, that would have bought you a house, a couple of Mustang convertibles, and you still have $100,000 left. I mean, 1971, that was a lot of money.
And then about James Barker, he was an innocent victim, wasn't he?
No, actually, he was only supposed to, Harper said he's only supposed to kill the two big guys, but Barker showed up while the crime was in motion, and they killed him too. He was a very good friend of the Henson and Kiersey. He was, and apparently, they liked to run out to bars and party together. Well, he apparently just stopped by, and that's what the police had theorized, that Barker had just stopped by accident, was killed. Because in his letter, Harp said, I was only contracted to kill two people, but he had to kill a third because he showed up unexpectedly. He mentioned that in the letter. And the police had theorized that's why Barker, because again, Barker didn't live there or anything, because if you were going to kill three, how would you know when they were all there together? And they all had apparently come individual at separate times. Because Henson, I mean, Gearsy came there first, but he'd actually hung his coat up in the closet and everything. And again, they think that they got in using Ted Ewan's key and had snuck behind. And they all of them had pretty serious wounds to the back of their heads, where they snuck behind him with like a tire iron or some heavy metal bar and knocked him unconscious. And that way they were able to tie him up before they cut his throat.
I cannot even imagine how gory that must have been.
Most of the homicide detectives I talked to who had been there said that was one of the most gruesome scenes they'd ever seen.
And the house is still there, isn't it?
Yeah, it's still there, 1318 North of South. Yeah. Imagine it'd be a hard house to sell. If you had to give full disclosure, it might be a hard house to sell, I think.
So what got you interested in writing this book?
Well, I'd been a writer for a number of years before that. This was like my 15th book or something. But anyway, when Roy told me about all this case, I mean, come on. As a writer, as you can see, this looks like a very good story. And plus, I was at the police department, so I had the case file. I got the whole case file of all the investigation from 1971, 1991, and 2000. I was looking for, at that moment, I just finished the book. And I was looking for a subject for next book. And I thought, this fits perfect, doesn't it? What I mean, true crime is a very popular subject to write. And when I heard about the whole case, Roy kept me up informed. Because Roy came to me and asked permission to drive down to Gibson County and told me what he had. At first, he and I didn't believe it was anything. Because over the years, we had hundreds of people giving tips about who'd done it. Well, I think so-and-so did it. None of them, not a single one had panned out. So neither one of us really believed this would amount to anything. Until Roy got down there. And it's like, yes, it does. So, and anyway, after I saw all the information Roy had gathered and all the other information, I knew this would make a really good book. But that's why I wrote it.
Now, do you think Fred told anyone else that he had committed these murders?
I don't think so. But the interesting part is people believe he had to bring some other people along. And there was a gentleman named George Smith who hung around with Fred. And Roy West talked to him. And he didn't want to, talk about it. And then, Roy asked him, point blank, said, well, you're there down to the south. And Roy said he wouldn't look at him. Instead, he looked to the left. Now, anybody that understands anything about interrogation knows when a person looks to the left, that usually means they're lying. They're trying to invent something to say. And basically, he said, no, I wasn't. I don't know anything about it. And Roy asked him if he'd take a polygraph test. He said, absolutely not. So, was he involved in it? We don't know.
Right. Well, it seemed like from what I read that the three guys liked to fight. I find it hard to believe that one guy could just go in there and take down all three of them. Even with the element of surprise, I would still find it a challenge.
If you knock them out and tie them up, they're probably going to... Because James Barker, in my reading book, I have a copy of the coroner's report in there, and it shows how their throats are cut. Now, Henson and Gershie were pretty straight cuts. Barker's was jagged and cut every which way, which means he was really struggling as they were cutting his throat. He was putting up one heck of a fight as they were cutting his throat. I wouldn't want to do that single-handed, one person. Now, I might shoot them in the head or something. That'd be okay. But you want to cut their throats, you couldn't do that probably with a single person. The reason the police believe that Harbison cut their throats is he wanted to make it look like it was a jealous boyfriend or ex-husband who had done this. Because that's what they, I mean, because again, if you just shot them in the head, it wouldn't look as vicious. If you cut their throats, it looks like you're really angry at these guys. And I think that's what Fred Harbison wanted the people that they had, you know, had some motive to really hate these three guys, which an ex-husband, ex-boyfriend of the women they slept with probably would have.
That makes sense. Now, since this involved three employees of Ted Uhland, do you think that they knew each other?
No, Harbison worked in the oil business thing, and the other two worked for the microfilm business. They wouldn't have crossed paths, no.
Now, I'm wondering about these guys, at least two of them. Did they know why they were being killed? And did they know who had sent their killer?
I'm sure they did. Come on. You ripped this guy off, stole money, you're stealing his equipment. So anything, when the police afterwards, they of course, after the house, they went to their business. It was B&B Microfilming, which is for Bob and Bob, Robert Gearcy and Robert Henson, just a couple blocks from where they live. And they were checking the equipment. They kept finding this typewriter stolen. Then they find this piece of microfilm equipment stolen. And interesting enough, Gearcy had, when he worked for Uhland at a place called Record Security Corporation, Gearcy reported a burglary there. But interesting, the police were suspicious because there was no forced entry and only certain pieces of equipment were taken. The other pieces, just as valuable, were left there. It was like they took just the equipment they needed to start up a business. I can understand being angry at these two guys, but the third guy just got killed, but he happened to be in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Most definitely. So then, for all intents and purposes, this case is considered solved.
Yeah, the prosecutor can say, like I said, I wanted to make sure I got a document from the prosecutor. The prosecutor said he considers it a cleared case, which means solved. And again, we didn't give the media anything on this at all. So I don't think most of the media even knew what happened. During a time, they really didn't know what had happened. And this happened in the last part of 2006 when Roy finally finished it up. But I didn't write the book until 2012. So enough time had passed. I think the media had forgotten about it.
I imagine that almost everybody involved with this case is probably deceased by now.
This happened, 50 years ago? And the older people in Indianapolis remember because it was a media sensation for months. And basically because of the sex contest, it always entered every conversation type thing, you know. So it was basically a media sensation for months in 71, 72. But it's been 50 years ago. People are pretty well for all. There's been enough new things come between then and now to kind of dull that in everybody's mind.
So if someone wants to buy the book, where can they find it?
Any bookstore. It's by Penguin Random House. It's the biggest publisher in the world. It's by Penguin. And so you can get it at any bookstore. You go to Amazon, you get on BarnesandNoble.com. They all have it too. It's called Slaughter on North LaSalle.
Now, do you have any new books coming out? Are you working on anything that you want to talk about?
I had a book come out recently. It's on mass shootings. It's called Prepare, and Defend. It's basically a book that tells you what to do if you suspect one's going to happen or if you're caught in the middle of one. What's the best thing you can do to save your life, to get out safely? There are a lot of things people can do that, number one, to see one coming, or number two, if you're caught in, to get out safely. And that's basically what my book's about, school shootings and mall shootings and what have you, and what you can do to keep yourself safe. There are a number of things you can do, because sometimes people do amazingly silly things during these that get themselves killed. There's a lot of common sense thing you do that can save your life.
And that concludes the story of the LaSalle Street Massacre. Robert Snow has told me that IPD closed this case without ever notifying the media, so it's considered officially solved. Robert Snow has become a true crime writer and has published several works that are available on the Amazon and Barnes & Noble websites. Please support author Robert Snow by visiting Amazon.com and purchasing his work. And if you are a parent, law enforcement official, friend, or relative seeking justice for an unsolved homicide case, please visit my website and complete the contact form, or contact me through Facebook. Thank you for listening.